So I'm going to repeat just for you who just came in. I just wanted to discuss the number. I'm going to discuss a few more things about the Poincaré group. And now the first thing I'm trying to do is count the parameters in this group. It's easier to count the parameters for translations. Translations are described by a constant vector. And since we are talking about, we are working in a four-dimensional space, this vector has four components. And I have no further restriction on what these components can be, so I have four parameters. Now, how do we count parameters for the Lorentz group? Those objects here, the Lorentz matrices, they are 4x4 matrices. So in principle, they should have, each matrix has 16 entries. So let me write this over here. But of course, not every 4x4 matrix is a Lorentz transformation. We wrote some conditions that these matrices have to satisfy. In particular, we wrote that this condition must hold. Let's try to see what this condition says. How many conditions does this actually impose? So this is, again, a 4x4 matrix. And of course, this is another 4x4 matrix. So in a sense, I have 16 equations here. So I could say that I have 16 equations. Thus, all the entries in my Lorentz matrix should be fixed. Is this correct? Does this equation fully specify what the Lorentz matrix is? No. So what's happening is, and excuse me for my very small handwriting here. This is a set of 16 equations, but not all equations are independent. Some equations are just the same. So how do I count the number of independent equations here? This matrix is symmetric. And so is this matrix, of course, because it's an equation. So how many, for a symmetric matrix, how many independent components do I have? 10. So the only independent equations here are 10. So I've got 10 equations, and I'm trying to constrain 16 parameters. This leaves me with 6 parameters. And the whole Poincaré group has 6 plus 4. All right, this is one thing. Which one is going to work now? Okay, now let's be specific about one more thing. I've been talking about a vector space here, but I haven't been very specific. So Minkowski, as we said, is a four-dimensional space-time. and any point is called an event. Now, we can define vectors at any point in this space-time. So actually, we have a vector space at every point in this space-time. This is called the tangent space at a point, say, P. We usually denote it by T sub P. And this is the set of all vectors defined at the point P. This specific vector space will also have a basis. Let's say we denote the vectors in the basis by E0 hat, E1 hat, E2 hat, and E3 hat. Or in general, this is, I can use the general index mu for this. And if my basis is this, then I know that for any vector that belongs to this vector space, let's consider a vector V in my vector space. I can write V is equal to an expansion in this basis. V mu are the components of V. In mu, the basis vectors. So can you, if you have a space-time, can you imagine vectors being placed everywhere? If I draw it in three dimensions, I can always draw vectors at the origin, but I can also take any point P and consider a vector there. Yes. Let's do an example. Let's take a curve, for example. And a curve is always described in terms of one parameter that let me choose to call here lambda. Now, the tangent vector at some point in this curve, let's say in this point, at this point, is defined like that, where again, this set of vectors now is a basis defined specific on this point. There is a vector space defined on each point of Minkowski. You mean all the vector spaces at each point are equivalent to each other?
Yes.
This is what you're saying? That's correct. Okay, so if we make a transformation here, if we make a Lorentz transformation, then the vector itself should remain unchanged. I'm only changing the coordinates by basis and the components of the vector, but the vector itself should stay the same. So, for example, this tells me that if I know that under lambda x goes to x prime, and I demand that v stays unchanged, then from this I can see that the basis vectors have to transform with the inverse transformation. These are things that we've seen before. I'm just repeating them now. Or as we saw in last Friday's tutorial, Thursday's. The inverse of a Lorentz transformation is its transpose. There are some steps missing here, but we have seen these things before, and I think you can do them. Now, let's define one more vector space. That we call the cotangent space. And this is the vector space dual to the tangent space, TP. So as we were talking about in the first days, there is a specific basis for this vector space that we call the dual basis. And if I label the vectors in this basis by theta mu, then the defining relation is that when these vectors act on the basis vectors of my original tangent space, they have to give me a Kronecker delta. This means theta acting on E. In general. Any of these vectors is a map from TP to, let's say, R here. We are talking about a real vector space. A general vector in this space, a covector if you want, can be expanded in this basis. And from this definition, we know how W acts on any vector V in the tangent space. So let me use a vector V expanded like that. And now let me do this explicitly. This is a linear map, so I can pull those coefficients out and write this is omega mu, W mu, excuse me, V nu, theta mu acting on E nu. And now we know how this acts on E. It's right here, so we get a Kronecker delta. which is just the sum over the components of a covector and a vector. And this is the usual scalar product. Of course, if you want, you can also think of it, you can also start by thinking of covectors and then see that TP is actually dual to TP star. And you can also think of V acting on W in that sense, and you will get exactly the same answer. Now, again, under Lorentz transformations, the covector itself should remain invariant, which means, and these are things that you can check, that first of all, you can see that from this relation, you can prove that the vectors in this basis transform with the Lorentz transformation, whereas the components transform, the components of a covector transform with the inverse transformation. And as an example of a covector, you can take the gradient of any scalar function. So if, let's say, phi of x is a scalar function, then we can write d phi to be the partial derivative of phi with respect to x nu. Times theta mu, where here we are using this dual basis. And when, again, under the usual Lorentz transformation, what you see is that what happens to this derivative? Let me do it. This now becomes a derivative with respect to the new coordinates. But using the chain rule, I can bring in the old coordinates here. Is this step clear? And now, again, this is a step that you should check. This is equal to the inverse Lorentz transformation. So indeed, the components of this covector transform in this way.
I'm not sure how to interpret that when you put the two brackets, so theta equals z, x,
This can be this can be a basis. Yes, or I mean, you can also just write it here. You don't really need to that notation if that's confusing. So I am trying. What is the gradient? It is an infinitesimal change of the function under an infinitesimal change of the coordinates. Yes? Yes.
I thought you said earlier that the coordinates transform like the inverse Lorentz transformation. So, like the Lorentz transformation in that
model. Okay, let me, if I said that, let me correct it. So the coordinates of space-time, which we almost always denote by x mu, transform with the Lorentz transformation. Here. And this is always true. Now, if we are dealing with a vector, the components of the vector transform in the same way. If we are dealing with a covector, the components of the covector transform with the inverse transformation. And what I can add here is that where is my I wrote how the basis transforms, but I didn't. So here I did skip a few steps, but let me do this. So these are the components of this vector, B mu. Now when X transforms like this, the new components become dx prime mu over d lambda. And now I can use the same chain rule that I used there. And indeed see that this is the Lorentz transformation. This follows from here. And these are the original components of the vector. So anything that transforms with the original Lorentz transformation, it is said to conform to transform contravariantly. The coordinates of space-time, the components of a vector, and the basis vectors in the dual space transform contravariantly. And what I had mentioned was once before is that a very good hint is always the position of the index. When you have an index up, the transformation must be contravariant. On the other hand, the components of a covector transform with the inverse transformation. And these are said to transform covariantly. So the derivative with respect to the components transforms covariantly. And thus, it is correct to say that these are the components of a covector. Now we can actually generalize this. And also define other objects other than vectors and covectors that we call tensors. And when we're talking about a tensor, we always specify the rank of the tensor. So let's say I'm talking about a tensor of rank k, comma l. Then this is an object. It is a map that takes me from k copies of the dual space and L copies of the tangent space to R. So a tensor of rank K and L is something that acts on covectors with K components and vectors of with L components. The basis for the space of tensors of rank K, L is a product of is the product of k copies of the basis vectors in the tangent space and L copies of the vectors in the dual basis. And the components of such a tensor should be k upper indices, should be labeled by k upper indices, and l lower indices. I don't want to write it again, but the whole tensor will be the product between these components and these basis vectors. Now, how does this transform? It will transform if you want k times covariantly and L times contravariantly. So under a Lorentz transformation, the new components of this tensor UL will be, if I write here the old components and I label them by rho 1 up to rho k and sigma 1 up to sigma L, then for every upper index, I need to have a Lorentz transformation. And I will have k of those. And then I should also have the transformations for the covariant components. And these will have to be inverse Lorentz transformations. And these are all, I should say, representations of the Lorentz group. It is the same group, but you can think of it as acting on different vectors each time. Nicole? Okay. Okay.
So we have k copies of something in the dual space, and in the basis line,
we have k basis vectors of the original tangent space.
Yeah.
So this is a map. Well, I could have also, I don't know why I chose to write it this way. So this is a map from k copies of the tangent space and k copies of TP star and L copies of TP to R, which means that, I don't know why I chose to write it like this. Somehow I think of it like this. This means that the elements in this vector space are elements of k copies. These are k copies of the tangent space and L copies of the cotangent space, but they act on elements of this space. So are you asking me about the positions of these indices? Yes, so in general, in most cases, you will have a specific position of these indices. A specific vector might be defined. Might be defined with components like this, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta. And depending on the symmetry properties, the position might actually really matter. But so the position, yes, matters. But here, just to be compact, we only care about the order that these indices come. So we just label them mu 1 to mu k, and the important thing in the transformation is that if mu 1 is my first index here, and rho 1 is my first index here, then there should be one Lorentz matrix which has one index mu 1 and one index rho 1. So for the transformation, the position of the indices doesn't matter at all, other than the order of the indices. But the relevant position between upper and lower indices does, in general, matter. So to make it more simple, I could say here that all the mu indices go first and all the new indices follow. We choose, for example, this positioning, and I should be consistent here and write the same thing. Okay, and to finish this discussion, let's just mention one example of a tensor that we have already seen. The metric in our space is a rank 0,2 tensor. So this means that the metric, if you think of it as a map, it is a map that takes us from two copies of the tangent space to R. So you should think of the metric as a map acting on two vectors, V and U belong to the tangent space. And this action is just given by the scalar product between the two vectors. Okay, so Nicole is asking whether when we're talking about the tangent space at a specific point, we are actually shifting the origin there, or why in general are we doing this? So no, the origin still stays the same. And therefore, my point P will always be labeled by some coordinates x mu with respect to this origin. Right? Well, since I'm drawing in two dimensions, let me use three-dimensional vectors. But for example, if we want to study the motion of a particle in space-time, this will be described by a curve. So let's say that this is a curve that goes through this point, P. So every point on this curve will be labeled by some specific coordinates or by a vector x. And the vector x changes as we change, as we move along this curve. Now, we are interested in studying various things. For example, we are interested in the velocity of this particle. Now, the velocity of the particle is related to the tangent vector at each point. So it is easier to think of the velocity as a vector defined on this point. And similarly, we have, if you want to think of this simple example, you can also think of the acceleration. Now, when we do special relativity, the objects we are usually interested in are things like the momentum, which is a vector and therefore has four contravariant coordinates, and other object that you will come across is the energy momentum tensor, which is a tensor with two indices. And all these objects will take different values at every point in my spacetime. So I want to think of them as vectors defined at each point. Does this clarify things? Kind of. Other questions on this? Okay, so let's close this topic. And in the remaining time, talk about algebras. And let's start with the lecture notes I sent you. So I'm sorry for the typos. Were there other typos or are there other questions or on the notes? No questions? Yes.
Krista, how to show that two group algebras are isomorphic?
Okay. So let's see. So we are talking, we want to define what we mean by an isomorphism. Between two algebras that I'm going to label here as A and B. But this is actually the same definition as for the isomorphism between two groups, for example, or two vector spaces. So let's take an element A belonging to the first algebra, how am I going to label my elements? let's say that we label elements in the first algebra by A's, AI. And we have a map, phi, and this is the isomorphism. The isomorphism refers to the map. That takes an element from the first algebra into an element of the second algebra. Sorry for changing my notation again, but I think it's better if I don't use the index I here. So this is just one element of A. A goes to phi of A, and this is an element of B. Now, we want this map to be 1-to-1, which means that any element of A is mapped into one element of B, and I can also find the inverse map and see that there is only one element of A corresponding to an element of B. It is a 1-to-1 map, and the most important thing is that it has to preserve the multiplication rule. So if in the first algebra I know that if I take two elements, A and A prime, in my algebra A, and they are mapped respectively into phi of A and phi of A prime in the second algebra, then what should be true is that if I combine phi of A and phi of A prime, this should be the same as if I had first combined A and A prime and then mapped to the second algebra. So this is the definition of an isomorphism. If I yes. You mean if this is a scalar vector space? Yes. So if one of these, if either A or A prime is a scalar, this is what you're saying. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah.
Is this what you're saying? You might be right. Could we have an algebra where this is not true? I mean, this is, I'm wondering if you can, this has to be specifically said if for some reason in your algebra, when you have defined this product to be something more weird than that.
I mean, yeah, that's already
Yes.
Taking back the space.
Yes. Okay, maybe maybe let's discuss this at the end. Okay, so in the remaining time, I want to give you an example of an algebra that you will come across later on in the year. And this is the general class of Clifford algebras. So I will first talk about the Clifford algebra, and then hopefully I will have time to also mention Grassmann algebras. So these are some specific types of algebras. You will come across this one when you study spin 1/2 particles, for example, that obey the Dirac equation. I will say more about this very soon. Okay, so how do we build this algebra? We start from a real vector space with a specific scalar product defined on it. So I should have said here it's a real inner product vector space, which has an orthonormal basis. Labeled by EI. I, the index I takes values from 1 to n. And now I'm going to put this in quotation marks because here what we really want is that, how should I write the scalar? Let me write the scalar product like this. So this is the scalar product in the vector space. And by orthonormal here, we mean that the scalar product between two vectors in the basis has to be zero if these two are not the same vector. And if they are the same vector, it's going to be plus one or minus one. Okay, and now we're going to build an algebra. We demand that this is associative. And it is generated by this set of vectors and the identity. And the rules that I'm going to write down now. I will try to not forget to use the start product when talking about the algebra. I'm going to read this. So product between identity and EI gives me back EI. Product between EI, EJ, plus product between EJ, EI gives me 2 times the metric GIJ, which is defined from the scalar product of the original vectors in the vector space. So when I say the algebra is generated by the identity and these vectors, I mean that the basis for my algebra will include the identity, these vectors, and any kind of other vector that I can form by multiplying these things together. So the basis of the algebra will contain the identity, all these vectors, and the product of 2 vectors, the product of 3 vectors, up to the product of n vectors. So let me use the labels I1, I2, up to IN here. So let me have a look at the lecture. So it is not hard, I think, to convince yourselves that given these rules, you can find the rules for multiplying any of these vectors. So GIJ is a number. Is a number. So here, this means that this is multiplying the identity element. Okay, this is the general definition of a Clifford algebra of dimension n. Now, let's see some examples and see why we are interested in the first place in these algebras. So, example number one, the easiest case if n is 1. My vector space has 1 vector in its basis, and my algebra is generated by 1 and that vector. And I also choose here G11 to be -1. So that the rules that I have here are, I call my only element in the basis E1. This is the definition of my algebra here, and the basis is just 1 and E1. I cannot put E1 star E1 in my basis because the rule tells me that this is given by minus 1. This is related to the identity element. This is the same reason why I cannot also include more elements in this basis. I cannot if I multiply, these are all the possible basis vectors have been included in this element. If I multiply this, if I take a star product with one more basis vector and start using my rules, I will see that this is actually a combination of the other elements in the basis.
Is this over the complex?
This is real, and this is real too. Okay, so this algebra over the real numbers, does it resemble one of the algebras that you saw in your notes? Exactly. So this is just the algebra of complex numbers. The dimensionality of the algebra I'm going to correct this because I confused two dimensions here. There I meant the dimensionality of the vector space I started with. This is not the dimensionality of the algebra. The dimensionality of this algebra is 2 because I have 2 vectors in my basis. Now, let me do one more example and then we will count the elements, the number of elements in that basis. Now the case n equals 4 is relevant to what I said before, the Dirac equation. So let me start by reminding you or just telling you what the Dirac equation is. This is an equation of motion for a spin 1/2 particle described by the wave function psi. So this describes a spin 1/2 particle. This is a derivative, and these are things called the gamma matrices, and these are the objects that actually have to satisfy the Clifford algebra. And I think I have time to show you why. So these are operators. There are 4 of them because mu takes values 0, 1, 2, and 3. Now, if you combine this equation, I think I will actually leave this as an exercise. If you combine the Dirac equation, this is Dirac's equation, so if you combine the Dirac and the Klein-Gordon equations, and the Klein-Gordon equation tells us this is plus or minus. So if you combine this equation and that equation, which also has to be satisfied for a spin 1/2 particle, you will see that this relation must be true for the operators gamma. Which is the mass, sorry, thank you. Thank you. The mass should be there. So if you combine this relation and that relation, you see that this is indeed a Clifford algebra with n equals 4. Yes. So, yes, if I take this operation to be my algebra product, then this is a Clifford algebra. You can build an algebra out of that, as long as you also define a specific product for that algebra.
Okay, but you think the basis of the algebra is like this? So
like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
You can build an algebra starting from a specific tensor space. You just need to specify what your star product is. So in this case, I am specifying my star product to be whatever the product of these operators are, however I multiply them in Hilbert space. Now, the simplest representation of these operators is by 4x4 matrices. Acting on 4 vectors. And why is this the simplest representation? Because the dimensionality of this algebra is 2^4 equal to 16. And to see that, let's count. I should have done this before, but let's count now that the dimensionality of the general Clifford algebra. So, of the algebra itself, yes.
Are we saying that the dimension of the algebra differs from the dimension
of the vector space that generates the algebra? So here I have. Here I have started from a vector space, but which has this basis, but this is not the vector, the basis I use for my algebra. I take this to generate a different basis for my algebra. So this vector space had dimensionality n, but here, how many vectors do I have in this basis? This is one. Use a different color. The identity is just one. And then I have n vectors ei. And now I'm taking products of n times n vectors. But if I interchange them, this rule tells me that they are related to each other. So if I know what E1 and E1 star E2 is, then E2 star E1 is related to that. It is not independent. So here we have n choose 2 independent vectors. Plus n choose 3 up to n choose n, which is just 1 independent vectors. Because here I have no choice. I just have to take all the elements of the basis. And the total dimensionality, if you add these numbers, is 2 to the n. So the dimensionality of a Clifford algebra generated from a real vector space of dimension n is 2 to the n. And same thing, this is what I used here. The dimensionality of this algebra is 2 to the 4. So the simplest representation is in terms of 4 by 4 matrices here. EI star EI. Okay. This is because of the rule that we are given here. So we don't need this. So this rule tells me that EI star EI plus EI star EI is equal to 2 times GII, right? I'm just using, there is no summation here. I'm applying this relation to the case I is the same as J. And we have said that GIJ is plus or minus 1 when I is J. So this would be.
GIJ was defined by the scalar product of two elements of your vector space.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. No, but I am defining my product to obey these rules, where actually I am using here GIJ coming from the metric in my original vector space. Yes, this is a specific algebra. So the name Clifford refers, among other things, to these relations. So if you're talking about a Clifford algebra, these rules have to hold, and then EI star EI will not be a new independent vector. In a general algebra, yes, they don't have to be the same thing. I should just finish this. I can either take 10 more minutes and also as a definition. So I can either take 10 more minutes and give you another example, which is Grassmann algebras, or we can just stop here. Grassmann algebras, okay. So again, we're going to define some specific rules for how we take our star products. So again, let me not write the same thing. We start from a vector space V. This has, again, to be a real vector space, a vector space over the real numbers. And starting from, say, two vectors, I'm going to use small letters in this case. U and V are two vectors in the original vector space. Then I define something called the two vector or bivector as a quantity U wedge V, where the product wedge has to satisfy linearity in the first argument. Sorry, let me use Greek letters to distinguish between numbers and vectors. So number times vector plus number times vector, wedge product, and another vector. This is linear. This is one rule. And this wedge product has to be antisymmetric. U wedge V is minus V wedge U. And the space that contains all two vectors that can be constructed from the original vector space V, we denote this by lambda squared of V. If the basis of V was a set of vectors EI, the basis of lambda squared will have every possible combination of EI wedge EJ, which I can also define to call EIJ. And since this wedge product is defined to be anti-symmetric, then the only independent combinations will be the ones where I and J are not the same. And we can continue this procedure and build 3 vectors and 4 vectors. And in general, we can build an R vector, which will be a product of R vectors. Let me just write this. So lambda R will be the space of all R vectors. There are things like U1, product U2, product UR. And now how do we define this product? We have so far only defined the product between 2 vectors. The conditions that, in general, a product between R vectors has to satisfy are it has to be, so this product has to be linear in its first argument. In other words, alpha U1 plus beta U1 prime times U2 times UR. This should be a linear combination of alpha U1 product UR plus beta U1 prime product UR. And it has to be anti-symmetric under the exchange of any pair of vectors. By this, I mean U1 product up to U, let's label this by I minus 1, and this is UI. If I interchange these two, this becomes minus U1 UI product UI minus 1 up to UR. So these are the two properties that the product between R vectors has to satisfy. And this is a new vector now. It's not hard to check that using these conditions, you can also show that it is linear in every argument. You just need to do some exchanges. OK, so if I want to keep track of things here. The basis of this vector space will contain all the possible combinations of R vectors. And now I'm finally going to build something called the superspace, which is the composition of all these vector spaces, the space of multivectors. And we denote this by lambda. This will include the space of real numbers itself, all the vectors in the original vector space, and everything else we can construct. This is a direct sum. It means that this vector space contains all the elements of this vector space and all the elements of this vector space, and so on. And now this is the space on which I am going to build the Grassmann algebra. So starting from a vector space, we construct the space of multivectors, and this is the space on which a Grassmann algebra is defined. Let A and B be two multivectors. Then we are going to define a product between the two, which is called the exterior product. And this has to satisfy these properties. If one of the two elements, say A, belongs to R, then A star B is exactly the same as B star A, and it is just the number A multiplying the vector B. If both are numbers, this case is also included here. So this is usual number vector multiplication. Now, if A is an R vector and B is an S vector, then the product between the two must be an R plus S vector. And if in particular this was something like U1, U2 times UR, and B was V1, V2, Vs, the product is just given by U1, U2, UR, wedge V1, Vs. And these things are well defined because they are objects in my R plus S vector space. And the final requirement for the exterior product is that it has to be linear in both arguments. It does stop there because the original, the wedge product there is anti-symmetric, right? So, yeah. The dimension of V, yes. N vectors in the basis of V. And again, if you do the counting, the dimensionality of the of lambda V or the algebra, it's the same thing, is again 2 to the n. So this is the most general definition of a Grassmann algebra, and you can build various Grassmann algebras. A specific example that is useful in physics is Grassmann numbers. And so that I don't take much longer, we will do this in the tutorial today. Let me just say two more things. So this is the exterior product. It has some interesting properties. For example, you can show that for if a set of m vectors is linearly dependent, then this is equivalent to saying that their wedge product is equal to zero. And in general, the geometrical interpretation of a product like this is the volume between the volume contained between those vectors. So your usual exterior product in three dimensions is such an example. A lot of definitions, I know. But I hope that this gives you an idea of how, in general, you can start from a vector space, apply specific rules, and then form an algebra. Of course, the algebras that are most of interest to us are Lie algebras. And you will see them sometime soon, hopefully. I guess it's time to stop.